News Extra, November 2020. Hello, and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the News Extra edition for the week ending Saturday, the 28th of November, 2020. My name is Steve, and I edit and produce this programme. In this programme, we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from the current editions of the Hearts Advertiser and St Albans Review. We'll also have our selection of national radio highlights coming up in the next week, which will be read by John. After that, we have another piece from the Talking News Federation, and this one is about the life of Helen Keller. Following that, we have another short piece written and read by Tom McNabb. This time he talks about the Boardwalk Mile, another piece of sporting history. And finally, we have this week's birthdays and events this week in past years. The music in this programme is called Gone Fishing and is by Gothby. So now the news, and our readers today are Leslie, Andy, Angela and Wendy.
Hello, my name is Leslie and my first article this week is about Luton Airport expansion plans which have been deemed unjustified. Anti-noise groups are encouraging proposed developments to London Luton Airport to focus on building back better in the next stage of oppositions against the present plans. London Luton Airport Operations Limited, LLA, hopes to welcome 19 million passengers per annum in the future, despite currently running at a third of capacity. In a bid to mitigate noise and reduce the airport's overall carbon emissions, campaigners are pressing for a reassessment of expansion plans in a time where passenger levels have significantly decreased due to the pandemic. Local community groups have rejected the current proposals on the basis of them being unjustified and unmerited. Andrew Lamborn, speaking for the Luton and District Association for the Control of Aircraft Noise, said, "The industry is innately carbon inefficient at present due to outdated airspace design, which forces planes into holding stacks and causes Luton departures to be held low, sometimes for 15 to 20 miles. After exceeding noise control limits for three successive years, Luton Airport has now signalled it wants permission to break four more of the planning conditions laid down by Luton Borough Council in 2013. John Hale, speaking for St Albans Quieter Skies, said, "The airport has to meet legally agreed noise reduction targets and should undo its recent mistake of allowing airlines like Wizz to introduce even larger and noisier planes like the Airbus A321neo. Luton Council needs to send Luton Airport a really clear signal that noise conditions are there for a purpose, which might focus some effort on growth balanced by mitigation, as the government requires." Harts County Council, HCC, has now sent a robust 18-page rejection of the plans. HCC recently launched the Sustainable Hertfordshire Strategy 2020, which includes the short-term ambition, clean air for all by 2030. Neil MacArthur, chairman of Harpenden Sky, added, "This significant and laudable HCC aim, supported by thousands of Hertfordshire residents, is clearly threatened by Luton Airport and airport owner Luton Borough Council planning for substantial air traffic growth over the same period. Luton Airport currently emits around 2.2 million tonnes of CO2, plus another approximately 200,000 tonnes of other greenhouse gases. The projection is for this level of pollution to almost double with planned expansion in operation. Councillor Derek Ashley said, "We remain extremely concerned over the impact of an expanded Luton Airport, both on residents through inadequate access and particularly on the wider environmental impact of noise and pollution. In the current climate, low-cost flying is not an option for a sustainable future." Bim Afolami, MP for Hitchin and Harpenden, added, "London Luton Airport's plan to work around the previous planning conditions to increase passenger numbers from 18 million to 19 million is poorly timed and ill-judged. I am firmly opposed." A spokesman from Luton Borough Council said in response, "The council's airport company, London Luton Airport Limited, has recently consulted on future expansion plans for which a development consent order will be required. Whether or not to approve that order will be determined by the Secretary of State on the recommendation of the Planning Inspectorate. It will not be decided by Luton Borough Council." A spokesman for LLA said, "Our consultation provided the first opportunity for the local community, passengers and business partners to feedback on our proposals ahead of a formal application, which will follow the relevant planning process. An environmental impact assessment is also being carried out to identify any potential effects and possible mitigations to ensure we deliver a sustainable plan for the future of the airport and its continued contribution to the local community. While current circumstances mean we are unlikely to see this number of passengers for several years, it is essential we take steps now to safeguard the airport, jobs, and support of the region's post-COVID recovery. This proposal is put forward by the airport's operator and is separate from Luton Council's more ambitious plan for 32 million passengers."
Hello, my name's Andy, and my first article has the headline, "New local plan will focus on climate and sustainability as current proposal withdrawn." The draft St Albans local plan, which identified land for future development across the district, has now been withdrawn. St Albans District Council will now start afresh on a new plan that will focus more on climate change and sustainability. Local plans are created by local authorities to outline where houses can be built in the district. The current local plan in operation across St Albans was approved in the 1990s, and a new plan would supersede the old one, with a modern and more sustainable point of view. A decision to withdraw the draft was made by the Council's Cabinet at its meeting on November the 19th, following issues raised by government-appointed planning inspectors about some of the content and the way it was prepared. A local plan earmarks land for future housing and commercial building, as well as the infrastructure to support new developments. The Council is committed to producing another draft for the years to 2036 to help provide new housing and grow the local economy. There will be extensive consultations with neighbouring councils, landowners, developers, residents and other groups. The subsequent draft will then have to be approved by full council and submitted to the government for an examination before it is adopted. A timetable for the work on the new draft will be given to a meeting of the council's planning policy committee next month. Councillor Jamie Day, portfolio holder for planning, said, "We felt we had little choice but to withdraw the draft, given the disappointing response of the planning inspectors. By starting anew, we have an opportunity to better address issues which have become ever more pressing since the withdrawn draft was composed. These include the need to recognise the impact of climate change and the need to ensure any new developments will meet strong sustainability standards. We also have to bear in mind that the government has proposed major changes to the planning system, and that may alter the whole local plan system. However, that is some way off, so we will carry on with the challenge of creating a new local plan under the current rules and look to see if we can gain some cross-party support for this difficult but highly important endeavour.
Hello, I'm Angela, and this article is headed Extinction Rebellion Activists Target St Albans Barclays. Climate emergency activists emblazoned stickers and posters on the St Albans Barclays branch, decrying the bank's roles in financing fossil fuels. On Friday, November 20th, staff arriving to open the branch were greeted with messages condemning the bank. One of the posters claimed Barclays is the largest funder in Europe of fossil fuel projects and is judged the second worst bank for biodiversity destruction. A spokesperson for St Albans Extinction Rebellion said, "We can all see the first impacts of the climate emergency, fires in California and Australia, flooding and deadly heat waves in Europe, catastrophic storms in the Caribbean, and it will get much worse. And yet Barclays continue to provide billions of pounds to support new fossil fuel extraction projects. That is inexcusable. What is more, Barclays also finances oil and gas exploration in the Arctic and tar sands extraction, the dirtiest and most damaging fossil fuel projects. We would encourage all St Albans residents that bank with Barclays to challenge their bank to stop funding fossil fuels, and if they don't, to move to an ethical alternative. If you don't, you could be inadvertently financing the climate emergency." In an earlier statement, a spokesman from Barclays said, "We facilitated £27.3 billion in social and environmental financing last year. We are determined to do all we can to support the transition to a low-carbon economy, while also ensuring that global energy needs continue to be met." Barclays added they published a statement in January and said they aim to help accelerate the transition to a low and zero carbon economy. This includes specific restrictions and safeguards regarding carbon energy such as thermal coal, Arctic oil, and gas and oil sands. They also said they no longer hold stakes in UK fracking.
Hello, this is Wendy. My first story is about a virtual sleepout event. This event has raised more than £30,000 for local homeless charities. The Sleep Out at Home event, on Friday, November the 20th, saw five charities come together to facilitate a reimagined homeless sleep out during the second pandemic lockdown. Not only did the event raise funds, but also raised awareness of the many issues that are faced by homeless people. The charities usually run the St Albans Sleep Out event at Oaklands College, but this year the lockdown meant sleeping out at home on cardboard, in a tent, an outside bench, or on floors or sofas. A Zoom event during the evening connected the sleepers together and created a community feel, where videos of support were shared from the High Sheriff of Hertfordshire, Henry Holland Hibbert, St Albans Mayor, Councillor Janet Smith, and MP Daisy Cooper. Information about the positive way in which the charities have helped people during this difficult year, a quiz, and inspirational live music from local artists Ellie Rees, Julian Mount, and the Maidervales completed the lineup. In total, over 240 people took part and have so far raised over £30,000 for Centre 33, Emmaus, Hearts Young Homeless, Open Door, and The Living Room. Sleepout participant Maeva Cowley said, "Still buzzing and feeling elated from being part of such an amazing event. Thank you to the organisers for making it fun, but also reminding us of the importance of why we're doing it." Fundraising Communications Officer at Hearts Young Homeless, Caroline Neal, said, This has been an extremely difficult year for all of the charities, as their income from community and events fundraising has been severely reduced due to the pandemic, at a time when demand for their services is growing due to the financial and well-being pressures on many of their service users. We are extremely grateful that the local community has risen to the challenge, and we would like to say a huge thank you to our event sponsor, Morgan Sindall Property Services, the sleepers themselves, as well as the family, friends and businesses who have sponsored them.
Next, an article about backlash after BIM backs Home Secretary. Harpenden and Hitchin MP Bim Afolami has given his full support to Home Secretary Priti Patel, despite an independent review finding she had breached the ministerial code by bullying staff. Mr. Afolami posted a tweet through his professional account, which unreservedly backed Ms. Patel, prompting a backlash from his constituents as the comments were made during Anti-Bullying Week. He said, "Since I entered Parliament, Priti Patel has been a true friend. She is kind, really cares, and is genuinely helpful. She's also doing a fantastic job as Home Secretary. She has wide and deep support across the Conservatives and the country." Constituents have reacted negatively in response to his comments, including Paddy Storey, the deputy head of St George's School in Harpenden. He wrote, "Now seems I've been dealing incorrectly with bullying all along. If you are generally good at what you do, you can't be a bully," says Bim Afolami and the Tories. "While we tackle people who are reckless about the feelings of others, bullying has to be deliberate," says Bim and the Tories. "Bullied people have to call out their bully and not seek help from the authorities until they have done so," say the Tories. "We say giving encouragement to a bully is actionable in school. In a Tory cabinet, it's expected of the bully's colleagues. What a joke Anti-Bullying Week in schools is. I hope this government won't dare ask schools in future about bullying policies or our actions in specific cases beyond belief." Other comments came from Martin Reid, who said, "As a constituent, I do find your persistent and unquestioning support for your ministers unnerving. Please demonstrate that you have some views of your own." Sarah Shaw tweeted, "Surely intent isn't relevant. It's bullying and harassment if the victim sees it as such and has alerted the offender to the behaviour." While Philip O'Cleary posted, "Bullies are like that. They have favourites. If Patel can get away with bullying because it was unintentional, why should anyone obey any laws? We can just say it was unintentional. Or does that excuse only apply to rich Tories?" Bim Afolami's office was contacted for a comment, but we were told he would not be responding.
Marlborough Science Academy shut due to coronavirus. The school was shut for most of last week due to coronavirus. The Marlborough Science Academy in St Albans published a letter on its website at the beginning of last week explaining that there is no other way to keep us all safe but to shut the school. There are cases in several year groups, while more than 30 teachers are self-isolating. Head teacher Annie Thompson, who wrote the letter, said year 8 and 7 pupils had originally been asked to stay at home this week. "Sadly, I have had another case in year 9, 11 and 12 since writing to years 7 and 8, which brings my staff absenteeism to 33, the letter read. "Years 9, 10 and 11 are operating at less than half a year group. I've taken advice from Herts County Council, and I have, of course, spoken to my Chair of Governors. I'm afraid there is no other way in keeping us all safe but to shut the school for all remaining students this week. Those of you who know me will know that I'm deeply disappointed with this course of action and the position we are all in as schools. Staff who are not isolating were in school to conduct remote lessons for the remainder of the week."
Verulam School's head teacher is to leave the school at the end of the academic year after 21 years' service. Paul Ramsey announced his intention to leave in August last week after over two decades at the school. In a letter to parents, Mr. Ramsey said, "I have enjoyed the challenges that each post has presented, and the whole school community has become extremely important to me. However, I feel that the time is now right for me to look for new opportunities in my professional life. I have relished the challenge of serving Verulam as head of English, deputy head teacher, and head teacher. I have enjoyed the privilege of working with wonderful students, highly engaged parents, and a collegial and committed staff. It has been a great pleasure teaching our students and watching them grow into confident and successful young men and women." Alan Gray, head teacher of Sandringham School and CEO of Auburn Academies Trust, commented, "It has been a real pleasure working alongside Mr. Ramsey in his time at Verulam School, both within the Beaux Sand Ver Sixth Form Consortium and more recently as a key member of the Auburn Academies Trust with Sandringham, Ridgeway and the two Wheatfield schools. He has led Verulam with great integrity and unbounded passion for boys' education." Verulam School's Chair of Governors, John Acton, added, "On behalf of the Verulam community, I would like to thank Mr. Ramsey for his 21 years of unwavering service to Verulam School. He's leaving the school in good shape with very strong GCSE and A-level outcomes last summer, reaffirming the significant progress the school has made in recent years. Now we will begin to look for his successor and continue on our path to making the school truly outstanding." The governing body at Verulam School will begin the process of recruiting a new head teacher in January 2021. Speaking of the remaining academic year ahead, Mr. Ramsey said, "I'm looking forward to working with students, staff and parents to ensure that we enjoy another safe and successful year and that we further develop our values of excellence, character and respect."
Do your bit to make our Christmas happen. If you want a relatively normal Christmas this year, then it's going to take everyone in the district to mask up and do their bit to help keep St Albans open. For businesses to be able to reopen and trade safely on December the 2nd, they need us all to work together to avoid fresh restrictions. An alliance of St Albans Independent Hospitality and Retail Association, Save St Albans Pubs, the St Albans BID, the Hearts Advertiser and District Councillors is now calling on local residents to help keep our district COVID safe and open so we can shop local for Christmas. The past few weeks have been dire financially and emotionally for our pubs, restaurants, retailers and cafes, and despite spending hundreds of thousands of pounds on PPE, staff training and undertaking rigorous risk assessments, they found themselves forced to close during the most critical time of the year. Sean Hughes, spokesperson for Save St Albans Pub, said, "Please stick to the rules, otherwise there will be a further detrimental effect on the rate of infection as well as potential fines. So if we are in a tier where it's one household only, please don't book multiple household tables, as this is against the rules, and it puts the pub and restaurants and hard-working staff in a compromising situation not of their making. Let's all work together to make sure we can open and stay open to enjoy all our pubs, restaurants, cafes and independent shops of St Albans." Council leader Chris White said, "I would urge everyone to remember the basics. Wash your hands, wear a mask, keep your distance, and self-isolate when asked. That's the only way at the moment we are going to get the district back to some sort of normality." Councillor Mandy McNeil, portfolio holder for business, explained, "Many residents live within walking distance of our town and city centres and view them as their local neighbourhood. It was great to see families take advantage of sunshine and enjoying a walk through the city centre and around the park in St Albans and Harpenden over the weekend. Many were wearing masks and social distancing, and we would like to encourage all residents to remember to do so and to take advantage of all the PPE on offer at the shops, including hand sanitizer." Our independent hospitality and retail industry makes 60 to 80% of the revenue over the November-December holiday period. It's critical that every single one of our businesses can reopen on December the 2nd, as the financial support from the government is not enough to keep them afloat. If residents can remember hands, face, space, they can help us to keep St Albans safe and our much-loved independent businesses open for Christmas. St Albans BID manager Denise Parsons said, "It's really important that we all play our part and wear our mask during this challenging time and support our community and businesses. It's crucial for our local economy to get our businesses open again, and wearing a mask will most definitely help get our numbers down locally, so please everyone, let's spread love, not bugs, this festive season." For those residents who can't make it to a pub, restaurant, cafe or shop due to COVID restrictions, visit the websites of your favourite locals, as many are doing takeaways, hampers, gifts and gift certificates.
My last report is headed "Christmas Countdown Gets Underway as City Switches Up the Festive Gear." St Albans is stepping into Christmas in a big way this week, as businesses, charities and residents light up the city with festive spirit. As well as the illumination of the clock tower in the heart of Marketplace, one of Santa's reindeers has arrived early and can be spotted shining brightly on the roof of Ladbrokes. Rudolph is just one of a number of beautiful installations lighting up St Peter's Street. The twinkling carriage is back outside the museum after its popularity last year, and there are a bunch of other surprises around the city to bring some Christmas magic and sparkle to the people of St Albans. St Albans BID, which provided these installations, is also responsible for a crop of Christmas trees appearing in the city centre, in Heritage Close, in George Street, at the Alban Arena and at the City Station. From December the 2nd to 11, shoppers can enjoy daily Christmas pop-up markets on the High Street, George Street, Heritage Close and Marketplace, featuring wares from local artisans as well as favourite local pubs, restaurants and food traders such as The Boot, Anastasia's, Costa's and Lusman's. From December the 12th to the 24th, locals can also look forward to the Christmas Charter Market, running the length of St Peter's Street from the top roundabout to Marketplace, with additional fringe markets from the BID operating elsewhere, including Heritage Close. Following the huge success of Santa's Post Office in Christopher Place last year, the BID is installing Santa post boxes in the city centre and elsewhere across the district this year, including Fleetville. The city centre post boxes will be easy to spot, with the famous knitted Christmas toppers on them, but the ones outside the city centre will also provide a direct line to the big man himself. Children simply post their letters, and once they've been sanitised in Santa's station, elves will reply on behalf of Santa. Just remember to include email addresses, mums and dads. BID manager Denise Parsons said, "You can post your letters in one of Santa's post boxes or in George Street, outside Cositas on the High Street, Fleetville Larder in Fleetville, or Eyes on St Albans in the Quadrant." The Cathedral, Museum and BID are also working together on a nativity trail, which will kick off on December the 19th and wind around the city centre with real-life characters dressed up to represent the various nativity scenes. Councillor Mandy McNeil, portfolio holder for Business, Tourism and Culture, said, "We know that this Christmas is different, but we are determined to make it as special as possible. The BID and SADC Christmas team are doing an amazing job, working in partnership to ensure our local businesses have as many channels as possible through which to safely connect with consumers, and that we retain the magic of the season for our local families, as well as looking after our most vulnerable residents. The St Albans District Council is also running a virtual Christmas extravaganza on its website and across social media channels for those unable to get out, either because of an enforced lockdown or other reasons, alongside a campaign to combat isolation, Stay Connected This Christmas, and a charity tree at the Auburn Arena promoting local good causes. Mandy added, "We are acutely aware of the fact that the pandemic has isolated even further those who were already struggling. We are lucky in St Albans that we have a huge number of community-minded individuals and businesses for whom these people are a priority at this time of year, who are working hard to keep them connected to the community."
Care Home Charity celebrates its diamond anniversary. A local charity, which manages its own purpose-built residential care home, is celebrating its diamond anniversary. The Abbeyfield St Albans Society, which runs Grace Muriel House on Tavistock Avenue in St Albans, is marking 60 years with a virtual birthday celebration. The Society is now looking to connect residents, friends, family, management and staff safely by way of one large online gathering, along with messages of support from some special guests. Newly appointed Chairman George Ashworth said, "Given the history of the Society, it is entirely fitting that we invite Daisy Cooper MP, the Mayor and the Bishop of St Albans to participate. While in lockdown, a recorded message from them, as opposed to them attending in person, will help to secure the safety of our residents, which is, of course, our highest priority. 2020 has been a very difficult year for the charity and the care sector in general, but we will continue to face the ongoing challenges of COVID-19 with professionalism, while staying true to our ultimate aim of enhancing the quality of life and well-being of our residents." He added, "This is a bittersweet celebration because we cannot celebrate the occasion in the manner we would wish. Being a much-loved St Albans institution, it is only natural that we would want to commemorate the occasion with the community of St Albans as a whole. There are some 11,500 residential and nursing care homes in the UK, but less than 1% of these homes are rated outstanding by the Care Quality Commission, and we are proud that Grace Muriel House is amongst this elite. It is a great achievement and is something that everybody in St Albans can feel proud to be associated with. I hope that the Society's birthday celebrations can further help to strengthen our connections with the broader community, including local businesses." The Abbeyfield St Albans Society has come a long way from its early beginnings in Stanhope Road. Having chaired the Society for 12 years until his recent retirement, Keith Faulkner reflected on its history. "In 1960, inspired by the work of Major Carl Gomm, a group of individuals came together for a sherry party in the Mayor's Parlour. Sir Victor Goodhue, the then MP for St Albans, organised the party for the purpose of discussing the establishment within St Albans of a home for older people. Despite the vision of Major Carl Gomm to eradicate loneliness, and despite his early exemplary work in Bermondsey, the idea had little initial traction. The thought of starting a care home in St Albans from scratch, without any financial backing and only moral support, was too much for most. The need was, however, clear to two serving aldermen, Frank Lavery, KSG, and Harold Child, MBE. With the support of Messrs Lavery and Child, Sir Victor was the third signatory to the establishment document, and the Abbeyfield St Albans Society was born. In similar fashion to the Society pioneers of 1960, the current Board of Trustees is drawn from the local community and provide their professional expertise and experience on a voluntary basis to support and help guide a dedicated, caring and professional team of some 60 staff to operate Grace Muriel House. Grace Muriel House is situated in a quiet residential area with links to the historical city centre of St Albans and a short walk to the local shops. It provides both long stay and respite care, and the friendly professional staff are on hand 24 hours a day to ensure all needs are catered for. Our goal is to deliver excellent care in a financially sustainable manner, George Ashworth added. Our mission is to fulfil our charitable purpose of improving the quality of life for older people and combating loneliness, whilst at the same time serving the community of St Albans. For more information, please visit the Abbeyfield St Albans Society at Abbeyfield St Albans, that's all one word, all lowercase, .co.uk, or call 01727 863 327.
Cafe Pays It Forward with free donation scheme. A Harpenden cafe has proven to be at the heart of the local community during the dark days of the pandemic. TK's on South Down Road has developed its own kindness scheme born out of grassroots generosity. The initiative kicked off in half term when staff prepared 68 free packed lunches for children who receive free school meals. As a result of all the donations received, the cafe staff are now making up hampers for some older adults and vulnerable people. Following on from this initiative, they have now launched a new scheme encouraging people to pay forward gifts of food and drink. Customers purchase items from the menu and then stick post-it notes to a fridge in the cafe, offering the chance for others to have the goods without paying. The hope is that people who benefit from the scheme will then add their own post-it when they are in a better position. Owner Claire Boothby said, "I want people to know what it's about. It's not about a less fortunate thing or a money thing. It's a community thing. What you put in, you can get out at a later point. People can use it for a variety of reasons. You could have a mum who's popped out and forgotten her purse, for example. One of our regulars comes in every week for a bacon roll and a coffee, and this morning it was on the house. He was really touched." The former nurse said Free School Meals campaigner and Premier League footballer Marcus Rashford retweeted their tweet showing a photo of the fridge. Mum of three, Karina Barneycote, received the packed lunches during October half term. "My children really looked forward to it. They had fruit, drink, a sandwich of their choice, crisps, chocolate and a biscuit. In return, they took artwork to cheer customers up, which was a nice feel-good gesture. I would like to say thank you to the staff at TK's. I would definitely use the fridge post-it scheme to help other people. The cafe is open from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Monday to Saturday."
St Albans' annual Polar Bear Plunge is back with a splash for charity. Earthworks' annual Polar Bear Plunge is back with a splash, but with a socially distanced twist. The green-fingered St Albans-based charity has teamed up with Youth Talk to keep the spirit of the famous Polar Bear Plunge alive over Christmas by taking part at home in the Sustainable Ice Bucket Challenge. Held each New Year's Day since 2016, the famous Polar Bear Plunge usually sees locals, many in fancy dress, taking a dip in the icy St Albans Sub Aqua Club outdoor pool for charity. This year, in keeping with Earthworks' principles of sustainability and to offset the water usage of the Ice Bucket Challenge, those taking part are asked to forego a shower on a day of their choice. Fancy dress is encouraged, and participants may win a prize. Past plungers have included penguins and elves, a stormtrooper, hippies and pirates, and the pubs of St Albans. Taking part this year is simple. Dust off your best fancy dress, donate £5, capture yourself completing the challenge, then post online with the hashtag #PlungeSt Albans, or send to plunge@earthworksstalbans.co.uk. Entries with the wackiest fancy dress are in for winning a variety of prizes. All profits go to local charities. Host charity Earthworks, receiving 70% of proceeds, teaches horticulture to people with learning difficulties, known as earthworkers, in their 3 acres of eco-gardens. This year's guest charity, Youth Talk, receiving the other 30%, provides free confidential counselling to 13 to 25-year-olds in St Albans and surrounding areas. Earthworker Jonathan, who plunged last year, said, "I enjoyed plunging and raising money for the charities. Everyone should join in." Bianca Badham, Chief Executive of Earthworks, added, "We can't wait to see the St Albans community taking part in this event, raising much-needed funds for local charities and keeping the Polar Bear Plunge spirit alive for another year." Youth Talk's Rachel Simkins said, "We're thrilled to be part of the Polar Bear Plunge and can't wait to watch our Chief Executive Officer take on the challenge to raise valuable funds in aid of Earthworks and Youth Talk."
And now, the list of people whose deaths were announced in this week's edition of the Hearts Advertiser. Jill Bush, aged 91 years. Mildred Crompton, aged 91. Basil Day, aged 98. Anthea Denton, aged 81. Maggie Doyle. And Graham Hill, aged 83. Now, a little more of our offering from Gothby, and then we'll have our selection of interesting national radio programmes coming up in the next week.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, November 28th. And a look back at 1953. This was, of course, a momentous year in the UK with the coronation. But also, as a direct result, there was the first time more viewers than listeners. An extra million people brought a TV, and so, previously relegated to the back of the Radio Times, TV was moved to the front. In those Radio Times, on Radio 4 Extra at 9 a.m, you can hear how radio fought back as Nick Baker explores some of the songs, sound and programme highlights that defined British radio in 1953. It's repeated at 7 p.m. if you miss it. Also on Radio 4 Extra, June Whitfield stars as Miss Marple in They Do It With Mirrors, Agatha Christie's 1952 murder mystery involving danger at a manor house school for wayward boys. That's from 1 till 3:30 on Radio 4 Extra. Over on Radio 4, you may prefer something a little more pacey, because it's at 2:45, the dramatisation of Ian Fleming's Diamonds Are Forever, starring Toby Stevens as James Bond. 007 investigates a plot to smuggle diamonds out of a British-owned mine in Africa by a New York-based crime syndicate. If rugby is your passion, there's international rugby on Radio 5 Live Sports Extra with commentary on Wales versus England in the Nations Cup. Kick-off 4 p.m. A slower pace, at 6:30 p.m, Opera on 3 features a concert performance on Radio 3 of Handel's Ariodante, recorded a week ago at London's Royal Opera House. Love and jealousy abound in ancient Scotland as the prince is tricked into believing his wife-to-be has been unfaithful to him. Finally, for Saturday, actor and comedian Sally Phillips hosts this week's My Dream Dinner Party. Her departed guests are Jack Lemmon, Barbara Cartland, Bob Monkhouse, Miriam Rothschild and Victoria Wood. It's at 7:15 on Radio 4. Sunday, November 29th. Desert Island Discs is on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. We don't actually know who Lauren Laverne's guest is. We'll have to wait and see. At 11:30 on Radio 3 comes Sola. We're all going on an oral holiday. Enjoy the sounds of Sola, a holiday town in the northwest of Mallorca. From sunrise as it awakens to the sound of a swarm of bees, to sunset with its sound of drums beating in the town square. A thoroughly engaging piece of slow radio. Drama on Radio 4 at 3pm is the continuing ventures of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, deceased. Set in 1904, New Mexico, lawman Pat Garrett has grown weary and old, haunted by a ghost from his past. Couple of choices of music programmes tonight. On Radio 2 in concert at 9pm, Joan Armour Trading is at Bristol's Colston Hall as part of a UK tour back in April 2010. Or you can hear Stephen Fry talking to Moira Stewart about a personally significant piece of music. On Classic FM at 9pm, it's Moira Stewart Meets. Finally, for Sunday, My Name Is at 9:30pm on Radio 4. Dr. Fozia Hayat investigates the fake news that is circulated about COVID-19 and looks at its impact on the NHS. On to those programmes now, which are broadcast each day at the same time on the same radio station. So Monday to Friday, every weekday, same time, same radio station. Book of the Week, 9:45, Radio 4, Boundless Sea, A Human History of the Oceans. David Abulafia tells the history of human movement and interaction around and across the world's greatest oceans, and the story begins with the earliest seafaring society, the Polynesians of the Pacific. Composer of the Week at 12 noon on Radio 3 is Beethoven. Donald MacLeod explores the composer's final years, 1825 to 27, which were marred by failing health and a traumatic family crisis, but also a period in which he produced a series of extraordinary late string quartets. Just after midday on Radio 4 each day, Monday to Friday, all next week, is Stella Gibbons, My American, read by Jan Ravens. The chance meeting of two young people from very different backgrounds sets off a chain of events that changes both their lives in ways they could never have imagined. Radio 4 Extra at 2pm for Balancing Acts behind the scenes at the National Theatre. Nicholas Heitner reads his memoir of the 12 years running London's National Theatre, a story of lunatic failures and great successes, such as the History Boys, Warhorse, and One Man, Two Governors. They were definitely very good. Followed at 2:15 on Radio 4 Extra each day by Rachel Joyce's dramatisation of Agnes Grey, Anne Bronte's debut novel, published in 1847. A young woman is determined to take care of herself and the family, but has no money and no prospects, so she takes a post as a governess. At 1:45 on Radio 4 each day is A History of the World in 100 Objects. Neil McGregor is joined by Andrew Marr and Robin Lane Fox as he explores what a small silver coin reveals about the life of Alexander the Great in this, the first episode. Finally, for our selection for the shows at the same time, each day, Monday to Friday, all next week, Radio 3, 2pm, the afternoon concert. It showcases the work of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, starting with recordings made last month of 20th century music for strings plus Vaughan Williams, a London symphony. Looking at programmes now for Monday, November 30th. At 11am on Radio 4, this week's episode of The Untold is entitled COVID Love. Fit and active 56-year-old Pauline Demoline was one of the first victims of COVID-19 to die in the UK. Her husband Nigel is taking part in vaccine trials in the hope of helping protect others from becoming ill. Grace Dent tells his story. Followed at 11:30am on Radio 4 again by How to Vaccinate the World, Tim Harford examines the logistics of a mass vaccination programme for COVID-19. Pinch punch and all that, it's Tuesday, December 1st, and as we begin December, Christmas is no doubt very much on our minds. So it could be interesting to hear Jonathan Friedland draw parallels between the 17th century Puritans' ban on Christmas and the prospects of a very different Christmas from normal this year. It's in the long view, 9am, Radio 4, and repeated at 9:30 in the evening if you miss it. The drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is entitled Fair. A taxi driver hopes it'll be a normal night, but then a dodgy geezer and his girlfriend climb in, paying him big money to drive around. The current series of Costing the Earth concludes this week with a look at electric cars. A ban on the sale of new petrol and diesel cars is now expected by the end of the decade. But can the necessary infrastructure, such as charging points, be put in place in time? Tune in, Radio 4, 3:30, to find out more. Over to Radio 3, the Ivors Composer Awards at 7:30 p.m, now in their 18th year. These awards celebrate the best new works of composers writing for classical, jazz and sound art. Nominees range in age from their 20s to their 80s, and many will be heard in interviews throughout the programme, along with excerpts from their chosen works. Generation COVID at 8 p.m. on Radio 4 looks at the lives of children and teenagers turned upside down by the pandemic. Listen to the voices of young people from all around the UK and from different social circumstances as they tell their stories. And finally, for Tuesday, it's followed, as it would be, every Tuesday, 8:40, In Touch with Peter White. Wednesday, December 2nd, 9 a.m, Radio 4, you can hear Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of England, deliver this year's first Wreath Lectures, as he charts how people have come to esteem financial value over human value, arguing it's contributed to a trio of crises, credit, COVID and climate, and he outlines how the situation can be turned around. The drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is where this service will continue. Susie has a busy day, but her plans are thrown off course by the sudden arrival of David. 15 months earlier, the two sat next to each other on a train journey from London to Penzance, and now he's tracked her down. A new series on Radio 4 at 6:30 in the evening is Sandy Toksvig's Hygge. From her wooden cabin near a lake in the Danish countryside, Sandy explores the concept of hygge, which means comfort, contentment and cherishing the simple pleasures of life. She welcomes celebrity guests to join her in front of a wood burner to explain what brings them hygge. It's repeated on Wednesday, December 9th on Radio 4 Extra at 5:30 if you miss it. 7:30 p.m, Radio 3 in concert. You can hear the London Symphony Orchestra playing Bizet and Weinberg. And for football fans, if that's your fancy, Radio 5 Live will keep you up to date with Champions League football. Seville versus Chelsea and Manchester United Paris Saint-Germain. Coverage from 8 p.m. Thursday, December 3rd, In Our Time on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. features Fernando Pessoa, one of Portugal's greatest literary figures. Melvin Bragg discusses his life and work with experts from Oxford University, King's College, London and the University of Warwick. And there is a repeat at 9:30 in the evening. Drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is The Beneficial Owner. Hugo Costello's drama explores the world of illicit shell companies and criminal overseas investors through the plight of an accountant who is deeply in debt and struggling to pay his children's crippling school fees. At 8 p.m. on Radio 4 comes Brexit, Is It Oven Ready? David Aranovich explores Britain's readiness for Brexit in 2021 and asks, what will the change mean for us? And some much-needed light relief then. Tune into Bob Harris's country show as he plays old and new recordings, plus reviews and interviews, 9 p.m, Radio 2. To finish the week, Friday, December 4th, The Power of Three is a new series on Radio 4 in which author Cole Morton presents a personal account, together with his wife and son, of what it is like to raise triplets. Starting with their 18th birthday party, he introduces the triplets to the man who helped conceive them at a fertility clinic. Power of Three, Radio 4, 11 a.m. Also on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m, the drama London Particular, a time-travelling story by Nick Perry. One night, Alice meets the gaze of a man as her train slowly pass in a tunnel. But it's her brother, whom she hasn't seen for many years and thought was dead. So she embarks on a desperate journey to find him. Something festive now. Short Works at 3:45 on Radio 4 features Alex Whittle's The Cronkton Soup Kitchen, a heartwarming story for Christmas. In the 70s, Whittle endured life in the infamous Croydon Children's Home, Shirley Oaks, before going on to be jailed for his part in the Brixton Riots of 81, and then becoming a lauded novelist. It's repeated on Saturday, December 5th, after midnight, if you miss it. Finally, Ian McKillen talks to novelist Margaret Atwood in The Verb at 10 p.m. on Radio 3 to round off this week. Atwood has, of course, been a best-selling novelist for many years and has been awarded the Booker Prize twice. But many people may not be aware she's also a poet. Tune in as she discusses Dearly, her first collection of poems in a decade. May I wish you, as ever, a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening as we head into December.
Here's an article from the Talking News Federation about Helen Keller, who, though blind and deaf, was an outspoken advocate for many causes.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
This is the story of Helen Keller, written by Sarah Sherwin and read by Tanya Austin. Helen Keller is known throughout the world as having been an author, political activist, and a lecturer on issues relating to disability. Yet her story really begins when she was a child and began to show the determination and ambition she would display throughout her life, which would inspire so many. Helen Keller was born on June the 27th, 1880, in Alabama. She was considered to be a bright child, having said her first word at 6 months and walking when she was a year. However, at 18 months old, she became unwell with what was, at the time, called brain fever, but later was thought likely to have been scarlet fever. This illness left her deaf and blind. Her mother, Kate, strived to develop a means of communication with her using a rudimentary sign language consisting of non-verbal signs like shaking her head to indicate no, or using her hands to identify objects. But by the age of 7, Helen was becoming increasingly frustrated by communication difficulties. She was challenging to manage, difficult, and started exhibiting extreme and aggressive behaviour, attacking and pinching people. Relatives described her as a monster, urging her parents to place her in an institution. At the suggestion of an eye doctor, her parents sought the advice of Alexander Graham Bell on how best to support Helen because, as well as being an inventor, Alexander Graham Bell was also well known to play an active role in educating the deaf. He understood the challenges involved. Both his mother and his wife had hearing impairments. He recommended that Helen's parents employ a graduate from the Perkins School for the Blind as a tutor for Helen. This was to be the start of Helen's remarkable journey, which ultimately led her, within a short time, to be able to communicate with sign language, to read and write in Braille, and to touch lip read. Her tutor was called Anne Sullivan, who was very well respected by the school. She was herself partially blind following a bacterial eye infection. Anne was from a very poor family and had been placed in an institution called the Tewkesbury Almshouses following the death of her mother from TB, tuberculosis. From all accounts, this place had a very bad reputation, housing very young children alongside prostitutes, criminals, and mentally ill residents. Understandably, Anne was very distressed by this environment, and it was during an investigation of the almshouses conducted by the founder of Perkins School for the Blind that Anne begged to be placed in that school. She achieved a great deal during her time at that school and was thought to be a very good choice to tutor Helen. Initially, Anne lived with Helen and her family, but felt that her outburst of temper, she at one point knocked out one of Anne's teeth, of temper and frustration had been indulged by the family. She suggested that she and Helen go to live separately in a nearby cottage whilst undergoing intense tuition within a more disciplined environment. Anne began teaching Helen using the manual alphabet, a skill that she had learnt at Perkins School. Each letter of the alphabet is formed into a different hand sign, and words are signed into the palm of the hand. A real breakthrough in her understanding of words came when Anne spelt out the word water whilst holding Helen's hand under a running tap. She is said to have gone on to learn 30 words that very same day. It helped Helen to understand that everything has a name, and in later years
she was to describe this moment, saying, "That living word awakened my soul, gave it light, hope, joy, set it free." Helen continued to make good progress and her behaviour began to settle down as she continued to build a vocabulary and also began reading in Braille. By the age of 9, she was said to be reading widely, including works by Shakespeare and Shelley. Having already achieved so much, Helen became obsessed with being able to speak as well as to read. When she was 10, Anne took her to the Horace Mann School for the Blind in Boston. The principal of this school was Sarah Fuller, who had developed a method she named Tad Omar after two young deafblind children who had learned to speak. Under the guidance of Sarah Fuller, Helen learned how to translate what she could feel in somebody's throat and the shape of the tongue into sounds, so linguistics. She could listen by putting her hand on the speaker's throat and lips and by touch felt the vocal cords vibrating. Her speech was not always clear, though, and Anne would often help interpret. Anne wrote a report for the Perkins School on Helen's achievements, which was published, and she became an internationally known figure. Helen, in time, began her formal education, and although this had challenges, ultimately she gained a place at Radcliffe College. Anne supported her throughout this time. In 1904, she had graduated from Radcliffe College a year after publishing her autobiography, The Story of My Life. This was later adapted to both stage and screen as The Miracle Worker, a reference to the achievements of Anne in supporting Helen in her remarkable journey. Helen was the first deaf-blind person to be awarded a Bachelor of Arts. Helen became increasingly well-known internationally and an influential and inspiring activist in numerous directions. In 1913, she became the spokesperson for the American Foundation for the Blind, lecturing and raising awareness of issues relating to disability and blindness. In 11 years, she visited 35 countries, which gives an idea of how she was renowned throughout the world. Helen, with George Kessler, co-founded Helen Keller International, an organisation initially aiming to assist soldiers blinded in World War I. The work of the organisation still continues today, incorporating programmes not only aiming at preventing vision loss and blindness, but also helping to alleviate the malnutrition and disease that might affect sight. The organisation runs 120 programmes in 20 countries. Helen co-founded the American Civil Liberties Union in 1920 with Roger Nash, who was a civil rights activist. She campaigned to remove people with disabilities from asylums, and through her influence, commissions for the blind were set up in 30 states. In 1964, she was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Johnson. Although she had hoped to marry, describing this time of love as a little island of joy, her family strongly and sadly successfully opposed the marriage. Helen died in 1968, just short of her 88th birthday. She is buried in the National Cathedral in Washington.
TNF Soundings.
Now here's Tom McNabb with another great moment in sporting history, the Boardwalk Mile.
A few weeks ago, I came upon a letter sent to me over 50 years ago from an old friend, Alec Breckenridge, from Glasgow's Victoria Park, AC, one of Scotland's top milers back in the 1950s. Alec possessed dual nationality, as a Scots-American, had run 4 minutes 9.2 at his best, and he eventually ran a marathon in 2:28 in 1960 for the United States and the Rome Olympics. Alec's letter went back to the spring of 1954, when the race to be the first man under 4 minutes was gathering pace. Wes Santee was the American hope, but the big danger was over in Australia, John Landy, who had been churning out miles in the low fours week after week after week, and would soon be over in Europe to make further attempts. Time was getting short for our man, Roger Bannister. But then there suddenly arrived the Atlantic City Boardwalk Mile, an attempt by the American half-miler Mal Whitfield to duck under 4 minutes in a straight, wind-assisted, paced run. Okay, so it wouldn't really count as a world record, but it would always be there as the first four-minute mile, and would almost certainly put a few bucks in Whitfield's pocket. And Alec Brackenridge, he had been asked to be the pacemaker. Of course, this was not the first such attempt. One of the greats of the 19th century, the professional runner Crowcatcher Lang, he had run 4 minutes 2 seconds in a straight mile on the Newmarket Turnpike Road on October 30th, 1863. Lang ran 55, 59, 62, 66 on his own, and I'd always thought that that first half mile must have been slightly downhill since it had bettered the existing half-mile record. But the Bell's Life report made no mention of any temporary or general downward gradient. But another account said that the entire road was slightly downhill, with the final 300 metres very soft. Whatever the truth, this was by modern standards a cross-country course, and with a pacemaker, Lang might well have broken 4 minutes. But let's return to the boardwalk and let Alec Brackenridge now speak for himself. Quote, "A good field had been invited to compete in this straight mile in the wooden boards from the Steel Pier to Convention Hall. Whitfield had been saying that he felt he could beat 4 minutes. I had not been running much, as I had been in my freshman year, but I was invited to the race on the condition that I set a fast pace for 880 yards. The course was roped off to keep pedestrians aside, and motorcycling police were also stewarding the course. Each quarter mile was marked by a large banner, white line in the boards. I ran in tennis shoes. Whitfield, he wore indoor spikes. The start was tremendously fast, with Wilt and Ashenfelter both setting the pace at 56.8 seconds. We had a following wind blowing us along, and I could not get to take the pace until almost half mile, reached in 1 minute 59.3 seconds. And at this point, another pacer joined the field, which was highly illegal. But I felt that I had not really done my duty and decided to take them to a fast three-quarter mile, actually about 3 minutes 3 seconds. At this point, being in the lead and seeing Convention Hall not too far ahead, 440 yards looks like 220 on a straightaway, I kept my legs pumping because I knew that Whitfield was on my back and actually finished the race 4 or 5 yards ahead of him. Through the tape, my legs felt completely drained of strength, but I was happy with the result, 4 minutes, 6.3 seconds. But at this point, the officials decided that I was not the most colourful character in the race and that I must be disqualified. So they declared that I was not entered for the race, but I was only a pacemaker. So Whitfield was declared winner in 4 minutes 6.9 and is still listed as the 1954 winner. The race was made even more farcical when he announced he had not tried to beat me because I was only a pace setter. For me, I was given a small trophy inscribed Boardwalk Pace Setter 1954. My coach, Jim Elliott of Villanova, advised me to forget all about the race and never to go near them again. But this I did last year, when I ran in some beach runs and in the AAU 15-kilometre race. I received a lot of favourable publicity, but we decided to forget the whole affair, one reason being that I felt it was a fluke performance, being on a straight track and wind-aided, etc. End of quotes. Back in 1968, I sent Roger Bannister a copy of Breckenridge's letter. He told me that he'd run against Alec on a visit to Scotland, but had up to this point known nothing at all of this boardwalk mile. Now let's go back to May the 6th, 1954. At this time, I was an officer in the RAF, and I was on a fighter command athletics course in Lincolnshire, and having toiled in the blustery wind on the rough track all day, was taking my rest reading a paper in the officer's mess. Suddenly, the head of pole vaulter Jeff Elliott popped round the mess door. "Roger's done it," he said. "Roger's done it."
Now we have our piece of music, Gone Fishing by Gothby, in its entirety. And finally, here are some well-known people whose birthdays fall this week. On the 29th of November, 1895, Busby Berkeley, the American film director and choreographer, famous for his elaborate musical production numbers featuring women dancing in complex geometric patterns, was born in Los Angeles, California. On the 30th of November, 1835, Mark Twain, born Samuel Langhorne Clements, and author of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, was born in Florida, Missouri. He was a Mississippi River steamboat pilot, which gave him his pen name. Mark Twain was a cry from the man at the bow of the boat who checked the depth of the water. Mark Twain meant a depth of 2 fathoms, or 12 feet, which was safe for the boat. On the 1st of December 1954, Alan Dedicote, journalist, newsreader, and radio and TV announcer, was born in Worcestershire. He is best known as the voiceover on BBC's Strictly Come Dancing and its American version, Dancing with the Stars. He was dubbed the Voice of the Balls by Terry Wogan because of his role on the National Lottery programmes. On the 2nd of December, 1859, Georges Seurat, post-impressionist painter of A Sunday Afternoon on the Island of La Grande Jatte and Bathers at Asnières, in the style called Pointillism, was born in Paris. On the 3rd of December, 1857, Joseph Conrad, who was born Joseph Theodore Conrad Korzeniowski, author of Heart of Darkness and Lord Jim, was born in Berdychev, in modern-day Ukraine, though he was of Polish descent. Until he was 36, Conrad spent his life at sea, and his books reflect his seagoing career. He is regarded as one of the greatest novelists using the English language. On the 4th of December, 1865, Edith Cavell, the British nurse, was born at Swardeston, near Norwich in Norfolk. She worked in Belgium during the First World War and helped British and French soldiers escape to the Netherlands. She was betrayed and arrested by the Germans for treason, even though she wasn't a German citizen. On the night before her execution by a German firing squad, she said, "Patriotism is not enough. I must have no hatred or bitterness towards anyone." On the 5th of December, 1839, George Armstrong Custer was born in New Romney, Ohio. He graduated at the bottom of his class from the U.S. Military Academy, but he had a notable career in the U.S. Civil War. He was a lieutenant colonel commanding the U.S. 7th Cavalry when he died in June 1876, with nearly 500 of his men who were killed by a coalition of Native American tribes at the Battle of the Little Bighorn in Montana, USA. In case you're wondering, the Little Bighorn is a river. And now some notable events which happened this week in the past. On the 29th of November 1963, the Beatles released their 5th single, I Want to Hold Your Hand. It had received advance orders for 1 million copies and would have gone straight to number one in the UK charts were it not for their previous single, She Loves You, selling even more. 2 weeks later, it toppled She Loves You and stayed at number one for 5 weeks. In the UK, it was the second best-selling single of the 1960s, behind She Loves You. On the 30th November 1936, the Crystal Palace burnt down. It had been built in Hyde Park for the Great Exhibition of 1851, but was moved to Sydenham, south of London, starting in 1852. It was completed in 1854 and was a popular exhibition venue for several decades. However, by the start of the 20th century, it had declined and fell into disrepair. It was restored in the 1920s, but in 1936, a small office fire went out of control, and within hours, the entire building was destroyed. On the 1st of December, 1919, Nancy Astor became the first woman to take her seat in the British House of Commons. She remained a Conservative MP until 1945, but her popularity and career were severely affected by her anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic and pro-Nazi views. On the 2nd of December, 1804, Napoleon crowned himself Emperor of France. The composer, Ludwig van Beethoven, had been a great admirer of Napoleon and had initially dedicated his Third Symphony, the Eroica, to him. But the story goes that when he heard Napoleon had crowned himself, he flew into a rage and scratched out the dedication. On the 3rd of December 1967, Professor Christian Barnard and his team performed the world's first human heart transplant operation at the Groote Schuur Hospital in Cape Town, South Africa. The recipient was 53-year-old grocer Louis Washkansky, who received the heart of a road accident victim called Denise Darvel. Sadly, Mr. Washkansky died 18 days later from pneumonia, because his immune system had been suppressed with drugs to stop his body rejecting his new heart. On the 4th of December, 1872, the American sailing ship Mary Celeste was discovered adrift and deserted in the Atlantic Ocean near the Azores. Her cargo of denatured alcohol was intact, and the captain's and crew's belongings were undisturbed. The sails and rigging were damaged, and the single lifeboat was missing. There were no signs of violence or a fire. There has never been a satisfactory explanation for the incident, and the name Mary Celeste has become synonymous with an unexplained desertion. On the 5th of December, 1952, the Great Smog of London began and lasted 4 days. A period of unusually cold weather, with high pressure and windless conditions, combined to collect airborne pollutants, mostly from the use of coal, to form a thick layer of smog over the city. Afterwards, a government report stated that 4,000 people had died and about 100,000 had been made ill as a direct result of the smog. It is regarded as the worst air pollution event in the history of the UK, and it led to the passing of the Clean Air Act in 1956. And with that, we finish this programme. Many thanks to Leslie, Andy, Angela and Wendy, our readers today, to Angela again for providing the radio listings, and to John who read them, to Mark who makes all the copies of the programme, and to Michelle who ensures you get yours. And of course, we'll be back again next month. But that's all from News Extra for November 2020. Goodbye.